WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You may know my guest Richard Bernstein as a New York Times book critic, former foreign correspondent, and Time Magazine's first Beijing bureau chief. After he turned 50, living in New York, he wanted to get away from it all. He decided to retrace the journey of the 7th century Chinese Buddhist monk Shan Zhang. The monk traveled 5,000 miles from China's ancient capital to southern India in search of the original Sanskrit Buddhist texts. His goal was to produce new translations of these classic texts, to develop a purer form of Chinese Buddhism, and in the process, to achieve the exalted understanding that was the ultimate truth. The monk's journey took 17 years. Bernstein's took about 4 months. His new book about both journeys is called Ultimate Journey. I asked Richard Bernstein to tell us more about what the monk was searching for.
I mean, he was after trying to resolve a paradox that's very central to his version of Buddhism, which was a very intellectual kind of Buddhism called Yogacara, the mind-only school of Buddhism, which holds that everything that we perceive is a creation of the mind. There is no distinction between the mind and the world outside the mind that it perceives. But the paradox then comes in the idea that, in other words, how do you create a sense that the world as you perceive it is empty, and resolve the idea that that emptiness doesn't apply also to the concept that you've applied to the world. As I say, I use the concept of, I try to use a very modern day metaphor to understand the problem here, maybe not the solution, but the problem. I talk about the yellow submarine by the Beatles, where there's a vacuum cleaner that sucks up everything in sight. And then once it's done that, it turns on itself and it sucks itself down. So one is the idea that the world is illusion, and then the idea that the world is an illusion is also an illusion when the vacuum cleaner sucks itself into non-existence also.
Richard Bernstein, you describe yourself as a secular Jew. What was your interest in Buddhism as someone who is Jewish but doesn't really believe in God?
Well, that's part of the appeal of Buddhism. I think you don't need to believe in God in order to find Buddhism appealing. And I didn't become a Buddhist, by the way. I mean, I'm still a Jew in the, you know, kind of secular, historical, cultural sense of that word Jew. But as I traveled, I gained a tremendous reverence for Buddhism and for, you know, this idea that there really is this thing that we call the wisdom of the East. And Buddhism, I think, embodies it or embodies some of that wisdom with tremendous brilliance. I mean, the concept of emptiness and the idea that all is an illusion and the idea that how do we know that what we perceive through our senses is real? These are ideas that don't get considered in the West until 1,000 years later with Descartes and the British empirical philosophers. And yet here you have, actually well before Xuanzang in India in the 4th century, you have people embarking on a very penetrating examination of that idea.
Let's talk more about your reasons for taking this trip. You're a book critic, and you say you were experiencing a quarrel with bourgeois life. What was your quarrel?
Right. You know, I remember one time I came home from being a foreign correspondent for a few years, and the night that I arrived back in New York, I was staying at the New York Times apartment, and I wanted to go out and buy some breakfast food for the next day. And I went into the supermarket, and I felt just tremendously depressed by all that sort of odorless, shrink-wrapped, packaged stuff that you had in the American supermarket. And I longed for the markets of Asia, where, you know, you can still smell everything, where there's just a kind of a color. There's the smell of blood and of death in the market, as well as of life. And I miss that. I miss the adventure of roaming around the world, of being someplace else. And I guess I found that, well, I have a good life and an interesting job, and I enjoy it and I appreciate it, that I had kind of stopped adventuring a little bit too early. I felt that I had crossed over the border of 50 years old, and I wasn't, life wasn't as exciting as I wanted it to be.
Well, the woman who is now your wife, who was your lover at the time of the trip, is from China. She's a woman who was a very well-known dancer in China and had come to the United States in the hopes of dancing here. And she, Zheng Mei is her name, went to China with you for the first part of the journey and helped you kind of finesse things. Part of your trouble was that you were having problems getting travel documents. What was the problem?
Well, the problem was that I've been a journalist in China before, which already put me in, I guess, not the best, most favorable light in, from the standpoint of the Chinese authorities. And then in 1996, with Ross H. Munro, I wrote a book called The Coming Conflict with China, in which, after which I found myself declared public enemy number one in China for a while and unable to get a visa. I tried for several years, actually, to get a visa to go and make this trip, and I got turned down. The American Embassy in Peking tried to persuade the Chinese authorities that this was a good project and that wouldn't reflect badly on China, which is true, it doesn't. But I still wasn't able to get a visa. And finally, I just went to Hong Kong to a travel agent, and I got a tourist visa that you get in Hong Kong sort of through sort of semi-official channels. But it looks a little bit different from a regular visa. And journalists, in any case, are banned from most of the stretch that I had to travel in China. So Zheng Mei went to be there in Xi'an, my point of arrival, to see what she could do if, in fact, I got turned back at the border, or they slapped me in irons, or tried to deport me right away. She was there with letters of introduction and so forth, and wanted to help. And then she stayed with me for the first couple of weeks as I traveled in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, the very westernmost, huge westernmost province of China that really is where the old traditional Silk Road goes.
When you were recrossing the path of Xuanzang, the ancient Buddhist monk from the 7th century, the most remote part of your trip, the most remote part was in Taklamakan. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You're pronouncing it properly. Well, the Taklamakan is the great western desert of China.
And you're right that this is as remote as it's possible to be and still be on the planet. What mm-hmm. gave it that feeling of remoteness, of differentness?
Oh, it's just its vastness, its flatness, its the sheerness of it, the way the air and the earth glitter together in such a way that you really can't even make out exactly where one begins and the other ends. I mean, Zheng Mei and I, until she had to peel off and come back to the United States, went on the northern oasis route, which is more highly populated than the southern route. But on the way back, I took the southern route, and I hired a jeep and a driver. And I mean, there were stretches where you would go for 10 or 12 hours down these sandy roads, and you wouldn't pass a single car coming in the other direction. So it is really the Platonic ideal of remoteness, of barrenness and farawayness.
So when you were going through this vast desert, you were reflecting on the nature of your trip. You were thinking about Buddhism and so on. Were you scared at all? Were you thinking about water? Were you thinking about what if the jeep breaks?
I wasn't scared so much along those lines. I was nervous in that part of the trip about getting found out by the Chinese authorities and being captured, as it were, and sent home before I could finish the journey. Actually, at that point, before the journey had really even gotten started, so I took a very low profile. I actually can handle Chinese fairly well from my years living in Asia and China, but I pretended not to be able to, to understand or to speak Chinese so as not to draw any suspicion to myself. One time I was having noodles in a noodle shop, and I made the mistake of taking out my notebook and writing down some notes, and I found the man in the noodle shop accusing me of being a spy. And then I worried about him going off to the police of the local town, which is called Jiayuguan, and telling them about this suspicious guy who was writing notes in a notebook while eating noodles. And then shortly after that, I looked at the very westernmost remnant of the Great Wall, which is in this place, Jiayuguan. And as I climbed up to the top of the wall, I saw three uniformed men sort of climbing up the wall in my direction. And I was terrified that they were policemen who had been informed by the man in the restaurant and they were coming to get me. But in fact, they just sort of started posing for pictures and taking snapshots of each other. So there was that danger passed.
It's funny how something that's the most natural thing in the world to you, sitting in a restaurant and taking some notes, just writing things down, is a sign of something awful when you're an American in China.
Well, I think actually there's even some political meaning. I didn't go in order to find out the political situation so much, but I was there when the United States accidentally, I suppose, bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And it was amazing how from one moment to the next, the atmosphere in China changed and how the propaganda machinery went into operation to create this intense mood of anger, animosity, fury at the United States and these sort of nationwide calls for China to be strong, to avenge the deaths of those who had died in the Belgrade embassy. In a way, there was a connection between that guy the man in the restaurant happened before the bombing of Belgrade. But that kind of touchiness in the face of American intruders is something that you encounter in China, even as at the same time you encounter basically a very welcoming a picture. People are very enthusiastic. And by the way, during the entire trip, I never did get stopped by a policeman, which in itself is kind of amazing if you think about the tensions in that part of the world, the fact that I am an American, that when I was in China, I left China 18 years ago, and I went to Xinjiang in 1982, and you couldn't talk to somebody without having your minder present, supervising your conversation. You couldn't go any place without being accompanied by a representative of the Chinese government. And here I was able to go to all of these places, to the very border with China and Kyrgyzstan, and to cross the border without ever being stopped or questioned about who I was or what I was up to.
My guest is Richard Bernstein, author of the new book, Ultimate Journey. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Bernstein. He's a book critic for the New York Times, a former Times foreign correspondent. Now he's written a new book called Ultimate Journey about his journey in which he retraced the route of a 7th century Buddhist monk who had gone in search of the ultimate truth. What was the moment of your trip where you most felt, yes, this is the reason to take a voyage like this?
Oh, there were a number of moments like that. I suppose when I met a man, the Shankaracharya of Kanchipuram, the spiritual leader of 800 million Hindus, and I sat with him. I was received very cordially by him, and I sat with him in a room, a very bare room, sitting on the floor. Supposedly his only possession is a wooden bowl. And I thought that he was so different from me that there's really almost no way that he and I are going to make a connection. And yet we did make a connection. And we spoke, he spoke to me about Hindu philosophy. We spoke about Judaism. We talked about the renunciation of the self. And he was so eloquent and so charming and so intelligent that I really did have the feeling that the whole trip was worth just this moment of meeting this man.
You write in your book about your really ambivalent feelings about home. You say you feel the sense of unease at the idea of home. And on the one hand, you feel like home is good, and on the other hand, you feel home is horrible. What is it that makes you so ambivalent about home, do you think? What do you dread about the sense of home?
I guess I dread the the routine of home and the ordinariness of it, the fact that you grow old when you're at home. I remember talking about saying something in the book about how when you're traveling, you have at least the illusion that that time is not passing because you're so busy that you don't really feel yourself getting old and time passing. Home to me has been the place of comfort and the place of belonging, but it's also the place that can get tedious, where you're too comfortable, where not very much happens. I use the expression the horror of home in this regard, and somebody pointed out after the book was published that actually that's a phrase from Baudelaire. I didn't know it, but I was kind of comforted to know that a poet of that stature had some of these same feelings of ambivalence about home, both as the place that you need, but as the place also that fills your life with a certain kind of lack of adventure, with a certain everything is too ordinary, the prosody of day-to-day existence.
And you spent much of your life, or a good deal of your adult life, in other countries as a foreign correspondent. But in the past few years, you've been home in New York writing book reviews for the New York Times. You discuss being single and being married in your book. You were single until very recently, until after your trip. You say that the Torah calls a man without a wife or without children half a man. Do you believe
yes.
that? Did you think of yourself as half a man before you got married?
Well, I mean, not literally, but yes, I felt very much that by not being married and also by not having children, which I don't have yet, that I was missing out on something very important, both for me personally, but also it gets to this, my sort of the way in which I'm drawn towards a kind of spiritual solace and spiritual meaning and religious meaning, connection with the past and responsibility to the generations of the future. And at the same time that as an unbeliever, I feel somewhat alienated by all of those things. And the trip was a way in which to try to work some of those things out. But marriage was kind of like that for me too. I suppose there was, in a way, if I had a horror of home, I also had a horror of marriage. It was where you gave yourself a kind of final definition, and it seemed to me in my mind, and I feared it. And at the same time, yes, I felt that you have some kind of a responsibility to live for something just beyond yourself, to create a next generation, to fulfill what really is a sort of almost, well, it's a biblical injunction to, you know, the Jews call it to be, you know, to be fruitful and multiply. And I had, instead of being fruitful and multiplied, I had always chosen this life of splendid isolation and solitude. And so, yes, in that sense, I did feel that I was half a man, half a person.
Instead of being fruitful, you were productive. You got a lot of work done.
That I did, yeah.
So what exactly changed on the trip that made you emerge as somebody who's really ready to get married? Part of it was, I think, that you spent more time with the woman who became your wife because she traveled with you on the first and final legs of the journey. But what changed in you that kind of opened your mind to actually making a commitment to have a partner and also have a home?
Well, the first part of it is important. Jung-mei, my wife now, my girlfriend in those days, and I really had a tremendous experience together. And there was a moment, really, this is almost an epiphany, when she peeled off to come back to the States, and she brought me to the train station in Kucha, in western China, at about 5 o'clock in the morning. It was still dark, and she put me on the train and said goodbye to me in the on the platform and turned around and walked away. And as I went off through the desert, and especially on an almost overnight bus ride, I sort of thought of myself going in one direction, and I thought of her on the train going in the other direction. And I did have a kind of epiphany that this was ridiculous. We shouldn't be going in opposite directions anymore. And that if she'll have me, I want to be going in the same direction as her from now on. And then there was, I don't know, I got it. I got something very important for me out of my system. I did it. I did sort of overcome my inertia. I shook things up. I just felt happier. I felt more comfortable with myself for having had this adventure, for having traced this man's journey, for having thought about Buddhism and the concepts that Buddhism brings into your life about the renunciation of the self, about you learn how, again, to strip yourself down a little bit and focus on the essential things and to be content rather than chronically dissatisfied.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Richard Bernstein is a New York Times book critic and author of the new book, Ultimate Journey. This is Fresh Air.